Welcome to the Laverne Cox Show, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
As the homes became more overcrowded, people needed to conduct their social life in the streets because every available space was being used for a bedroom for multiple families living in space that should have been for a single family. Government stopped collecting garbage as frequently in those neighborhoods as they became African-American, and they became slums. And whites looked at those slums and they decide, well, African-Americans are slum dwellers, not understanding that the slum conditions were created by government policy.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Laverne Cox Show. I'm Laverne Cox. In America, owning a home is presented as like part of the American dream. And I've always wanted to own my own home. I bought my first home about almost 3 years ago now. And it was a huge thing for me, especially as someone who used to live in government subsidized housing. And when I think about being Black, being African American, and being a homeowner, I can't help but think about the history of how that has been a fraught enterprise for a lot of Black people in this country. And I can't help but think about the relationship between home ownership and wealth, and then home ownership and structural racism. And I knew when I had this podcast that I would want to have a conversation about residential segregation, home ownership, and structural racism. And I discovered this book called The Color of Law through the For Harriet YouTube page. Shout out to Kimberly Foster. And I knew I wanted to have Richard Rothstein, who wrote the book, on the podcast to talk about the history of racial segregation in the United States. Richard Rothstein is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. According to the New York Times, there is no better history of housing segregation. Mr. Rothstein is a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow emeritus at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Please enjoy my conversation with Richard Rothstein. Hello, Richard Rothstein, and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. I appreciate being with you.
I'm so excited that you're here to have this conversation with me. So in your amazing book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, you use the term de jure segregation a lot. So can we start off by having you define, because I think a lot of people might not hear that term, de jure segregation. Can you define that in relationship to de facto segregation for us, please?
Certainly. We have a national myth in this country that the reason we're so racially segregated, with every metropolitan area having clearly defined areas that are all white or mostly white, and clearly defined areas that are all Black or mostly Black, that the reason that's we're so segregated is because of private activity, because of banks or real estate agents or insurance companies that discriminated, wouldn't insure mortgages for African Americans, because of bigoted homeowners or landlords who wouldn't rent or sell to African Americans. Or maybe we tell ourselves that it's all because people like to live with each other of the same race, and that's why we're so segregated, they choose to do it. Or maybe we tell ourselves it's just because of income differences. On average, African Americans have lower incomes than whites, and so many African Americans can't afford to move to higher opportunity neighborhoods. And we tell ourselves this is the reason we're segregated. The Supreme Court has embraced this view, and it's given a name to this view. It says we have de facto segregation, something that just happened in fact, not by policy, not by law, not by ordinance, not by regulation. Just sort of happened naturally. And the Supreme Court has said, and we've all adopted this view, that if it happened naturally, if it happened by accident, de facto segregation, not by government, then it wasn't a constitutional violation. There's nothing unconstitutional about it. It's not a civil rights violation. It's just self-choice and private bigotry. And the Supreme Court said, if you have something that just happened naturally, happened by accident, de facto segregation, it can only unhappen by accident. There's nothing we have an obligation to do anything about because it's not a civil rights violation. In contrast, if we thought that the residential segregation of every metropolitan area was not accidental, but the product of very explicit federal, state, and local policy designed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area, that's a civil rights violation. We call that de jure segregation. And if it's a civil rights violation, we have an obligation as American citizens to undo it, to remedy it. Mm. And that's what why the two terms are so significant. The first, de facto segregation, is a paralyzing myth because it prevents us from feeling an obligation to redress segregation. The second, the reality that I describe in my book of many, many federal, state, and local policies that were racially explicit, that are the cause of residential segregation today, that created it, sustained it, perpetuated it. It's a civil rights violation. Our racial boundaries in every metropolitan area are as much a civil rights violation as the segregation of schools or water fountains or buses or any of the things we addressed in the 20th century. But this one we've left untouched. And so it's important to understand the history of how our government segregated America, because if we understand this history, then we have no choice but to accept the obligation to remedy it because it's a violation of our Constitution.
Wow, you said so much there. It's like you just said, if we accept the history, we have no choice. And I feel so often in this country, maybe it's that we don't want to accept the history. And I think white supremacy seems to exist in a sort of sense of perpetual sort of denial that it's something that's going on. So, but before we get there, I would love to talk about some of the ways in which in the 20th century, our government participated in what you call de jure segregation. And I love the way you start your book. You tell us about the story of a man named Frank Stevenson. Can you tell us a bit about Mr. Stevenson and the story of Richmond, California?
Sure. During World War II, hundreds of thousands of white and black workers flocked to the West Coast to take jobs in war industries, making airplanes and ships, tanks and jeeps. Well, Frank Stevenson came to California as a young man during World War II and got a job in a Ford plant that had been converted to making tanks and jeeps. And at the end of the war, that plant converted back into the manufacture of automobiles. And it did so for about 10 years. And then in 1955, that plant moved to the suburbs. At the time, many, many urban plants were moving to suburban locations because all of a sudden the highways were being built and plants no longer needed to be located near a deep water port or a railroad terminal to get their parts and ship their final products. Richmond was a deep water port. That's why the Ford plant was there. Mm-hmm. But they moved to a suburb called Milpitas, but now part of Silicon Valley in California. And the United Auto Workers, the union, negotiated an agreement with Ford that all the workers in the Richmond plant could move to Milpitas. It was about 50 miles away. The workers in that plant had the opportunity to keep their jobs by moving to Milpitas, but the white workers were able to move because there was housing for them. The African-American workers were not able to move because there was no housing for them. Well, why was there no housing for them? The reason there was no housing for them was that the federal government had embarked in the period after World War II to create suburbs like Milpitas with single-family homes for white workers only, and created these suburbs with a prohibition that any homes could be occupied by African-Americans. This was an explicit racial policy. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the biggest and best well-known of these is you've heard of it, Levittown, east of New York City.
Absolutely.
17,000 homes in one place.
Yes.
But the suburbs and the communities in Milpitas were smaller, but still financed by the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration before that. Levitt or these other developers, Frank Bohannon in Northern California in the Milpitas area, these developers could never have assembled the capital to build these suburbs on their own because we weren't a suburban country yet. Mm-hmm. And the banks thought this was a crazy idea. Why would you lend somebody the money, in Levitt's case, to build 17,000 homes that nobody was going to want to buy? Who wants to move to the suburbs? Mm-hmm. The only way that these developers Frank Bohannon in the East Bay, or Levitt in Levittown, or any of the others. The only way they could build these projects was by going to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration, submitting their plans for the projects, the architectural design of the homes, the layout of the streets, the construction materials they were going to use, and a commitment required by the Federal Housing or Veterans Administration never to sell a home to an African American.
Now, do we know why they didn't want to sell to African Americans, and they wanted these to have these communities in the suburbs be exclusively white? Was there a reason, or they were just like, we can't have Black people there?
Well, this country has never dealt with the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. And it was assumed by policymakers. They didn't have to say why. It was assumed by policymakers, as well as many of their constituents, that African Americans were an inferior race and didn't belong mixing with whites. This was not just a phenomenon in the South. It was a policy of the National Democratic Party. It's very interesting. You know, I talk in the book, In the Color of Law, as you may recall, Laverne, that you know, in 1913, Woodrow Wilson was elected president of the United States. He was the first Southern Democrat to be elected president since the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, prior to 1913, when he assumed office, we had an integrated federal civil service. Mm. Integrated. The civil service wasn't large like it is today, but it was an integrated federal civil service. The Wilson administration embarked on a program to segregate the federal civil service for the first time in 1913. This was 50 years after the end of the Civil War, just about. So this is not something that dates from the end of the Civil War. This is something that was imposed in the 20th century. Well, the biggest department in the government, one of the biggest departments in the government at that time, was the Navy Department. In all departments of the government, they were putting up curtains to separate Black and white workers in federal office buildings. They were firing any African Americans who were in supervisory positions because it was no longer permitted for African Americans to supervise whites. Separate washing facilities were established in basements for African American workers. Well, as I said, the Navy Department was one of the largest departments. And who was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy at that time in 1913? This is a quiz.
I have no idea.
No clue. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1913, who was responsible for segregating the Navy Department, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was Roosevelt's idea or he would have done it on his own, but he certainly didn't object. And this is the environment of the Democratic Party with which he matured as a politician and eventually, 20 years later, was elected president of the United States and implemented these policies that I've described. Now, as you may know, when Roosevelt was first elected in 1932, African Americans didn't support him. They voted overwhelmingly for the Republican candidate, Herbert Hoover.
Well, Republicans voted Republican until the realignment in 1968, I think, post the Civil Rights Act. Blacks tended to vote Republican because the Democratic Party was the pro sort of segregation party. Am I completely wrong with that in my American history?
Yeah, I don't think that's right. The big shift of African Americans to the Democratic Party took place in 1936. Uh-huh. 4 years after Roosevelt was elected. And the reason they shifted to the Democratic Party was because prior to that, prior to the New Deal, to the Depression, to the Roosevelt administration, the federal government never offered any benefits to African Americans. Mm. Under Roosevelt, the federal government offered segregated benefits to African Americans, and the African American voting population, on the whole, thought that segregated benefits were better than no benefits at all.
Can you explain the segregated benefits, the details of how the New Deal was segregated and how certain policies, particularly in terms of wages, were disparate in relationship to Black folks?
There are many, many policies. Let me describe one that I talk about at great length in my book because it has the impact on residential segregation that we know today. There was no public housing in this country prior to the New Deal. As I say, the previous administrations gave no benefits of any kind to African Americans or to whites for that matter. the first public housing in this country, the first civilian public housing in this country, was created by the Roosevelt administration when it first took office. The Public Works Administration, one of the first New Deal agencies, built the first civilian public housing in this country. And everywhere it built segregated projects, separate projects for whites, separate projects for African Americans.
And this isn't just in the South, this is all over the country. And people should know that even though Jim Crow was a thing of the South, that segregated housing was all over the country. We talked about California, yes. We talked about Levittown in New York.
Yes, well, I'm sure you're familiar with the great African-American poet, novelist, playwright, Langston Hughes.
Of course.
He grew up in Cleveland. In his autobiography, he describes how he grew up in an integrated Cleveland neighborhood. There were many downtown integrated neighborhoods at that time. We'd be stunned if we were transported back to that period in history. The reason is simple, why there were so many integrated neighborhoods. I mentioned earlier that we were a manufacturing economy and all the factories had to be located in a central district near a deep water port or a railroad terminal. And because workers in those factories didn't have automobiles to drive to work, they had to live relatively close to the factories. So there were many broadly integrated neighborhoods. I'm not suggesting every other house was a different race, but broadly integrated neighborhoods in downtown areas. Langston Hughes grew up in one of them in Cleveland. He said when he went to high school, it was an integrated high school. He said his best friend was Polish. He said he dated a Jewish girl in high school, integrated high school, an integrated neighborhood. That's not surprising. Mm-hmm. Public Works Administration went into that neighborhood of Cleveland, demolished housing there, and created two separate projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating segregation where it hadn't previously existed. And you observe this was not just in the South. It was in the North. It was in places that the self-satisfied smug places that today think they're better than everybody else on these issues. One of the ones I described in The Color of Law is Cambridge, Massachusetts. I imagine you may have heard of that. The area in Cambridge between Harvard and MIT, the Central Square neighborhood, was a fully integrated neighborhood in the 1930s. But the Public Works Administration created segregation there for the first time. A separate project for whites, a separate project for African Americans created by the federal government, creating segregation there and with other segregated projects elsewhere in Boston that created a pattern that exists to this day. Now, as you mentioned earlier, it wasn't just in housing policy. The Civilian Conservation Corps, the federal program that provided jobs for the first time during the Depression, had segregated work units, not just in the South, in the North as well. National legislation, like the Social Security Act or the Fair Labor Standards Act, that is the minimum wage law, the first minimum wage law, were adopted in the 1930s, excluded occupations from their coverage where African Americans participated. Agriculture, for example, or domestic work were excluded from Social Security or minimum wage laws because these were predominantly African American populations. Now, let me just say the Social Security Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act excluded African Americans because Southern congressmen and senators demanded that exclusion. But no Southern Democrats, no Southern congressmen or senators insisted that housing projects in Cleveland be segregated. That's a different, there's no national program that requires the same policy to be followed everywhere. So even if, and I'm not suggesting that they should have done this, but even if the Roosevelt administration had created segregated projects in the South to pacify Southern congressmen and senators, there's no reason why they had to create segregated projects in Cleveland or in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in California or any of the other places they did it. This was a policy of the Democratic Party. African Americans, as I said, were grateful to get any housing at all because we had a terrible housing shortage in the Depression. And so they flocked to the Democratic Party as a result. And segregated benefits were better than no benefits at all, in their view.
And I think that is that's the piece that is so intense that there were so many, there were integrated communities and the government forced this segregation, which just boggles my mind on so many different levels. So this is the Public Works Administration. So this is a result of Roosevelt. And then the next big push for, we can call it government subsidized housing, would be after World War II, which you alluded to a bit earlier. And we go to places like Levittown, right? So You've talked a little bit about the FHA loans. Can you tell us the difference between that and redlining?
Well, I will, but I want to, if I may, and I think you'd like to hear this, I'd like to say something a bit more about the FHA.
Okay.
Its subsidies of these suburbs.
Please.
These suburbs that were created by the FHA and VA, the Veterans Administration, in the post-World War II period, were affordable to working-class families of either race. Blacks and whites could have afforded them. Returning war veterans, whether they were black or white, could have afforded them. They were inexpensive homes. No down payment, very small, modest homes, 750 square feet, two bedroom, one bath, modest homes, working class families. Whites were subsidized to move to them. African Americans prohibited. They sold at the time for about $8,000. In today's money, that's about $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those homes, as you know, don't sell for $100,000 today. The homes in Milpitas, $1 million. The homes in Levittown, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 perhaps. The white working class families, returning war veterans, were subsidized to move to these suburbs, gained over the next couple of generations wealth from the appreciation of the value of their homes. African Americans were prohibited from participating in this wealth generating program. The result is that today, African-American incomes, on average, are about 60%, 60% of white incomes. There are a number of reasons for that. Some of them I mentioned a few minutes ago when we talked about the Social Security Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act. But you would think if the African-American families, on average, had 60% of the incomes of white families, African-Americans would also have 60% of the wealth, on average, of white families. You can save the same amount of money from the same incomes. The reality, though, is that while African-American incomes, on average, are about 60% of white family incomes, African-American household wealth is about 5% of white wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century. It's never been remedied, and we have an obligation to remedy. That 5% wealth gap is the contributor, major way, to the ongoing inequality that we have today. It explains why, even though housing discrimination is now against the law, these suburbs are no longer accessible to working-class families of either race. Whites, if they have down payments that they've been bequeathed by their parents and grandparents who gained wealth from these appreciating homes, they can move to these suburbs. But African Americans who have no wealth cannot do so. So the ongoing segregation that we have today is in good part an ongoing effect of these federal policies. Now, you asked about redlining.
Actually, before we get to redlining, I'd love to just emphasize what you just said, because I think it's really important. Last year, post George Floyd's horrible murder, there were a lot of conversations online about structural racism. Actually, I shared a video on my Instagram page about structural racism. And then I began to see online all these people attempting to debunk that video and like say structural racism is something that doesn't exist. I think that residential segregation is a really good example, and these policies are a really good example of structural racism and how that structural racism continues to have disparate outcomes for Black and white people till this day. When we look at the wealth gap, when we actually look at education, there's a relationship between housing and education. There's so many things that we can look at around housing policy that are consistent to this day.
This is a good time to take a little break. We'll be right back, though. Okay, that's taken care of. Let's get back to our chat.
A dear friend of mine just bought a house in Beechwood Canyon here in Los Angeles, and her attorney told her that there was a racial covenant in the contract. She's a Black woman. So apparently she was the first Black person, you know, to buy the house. But this is 2021. She just closed in her house, and there's still a racial covenant in the contract. Can you actually explain to people what racial covenants are? Because I think everybody might not know.
Sure. I mentioned before that in order to get the guaranteed bank loans from the federal government, The developers not only had to agree never to sell a home to an African American, but they had to include a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. These clauses in deeds are called covenants, restrictive covenants. In California, they're part of the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, which is an amendment to the deed. Well, you can't change a deed once language is in there. You can make it unenforceable, and of course, those racial covenants are now unenforceable. But the language remains. You can't change, you can't remove something from your deed anymore. You can wake up in the middle of the night and say you want to change your property line. The deed is the deed. And so this language continues to exist. And it's important that people look at their deeds and be reminded of how their community was segregated. This wasn't a natural phenomenon. This was an explicit requirement. Now, many of these deeds have these racial covenants, even without a government requirement. I'm not suggesting that the only time you'll find a deed is when the government required it. There were many private builders who put these deeds in even when they didn't have federal financing. But this is an example of how African Americans were excluded from these suburbs, not only when they were first built, but later on when the original owners might have wanted to resell them. There were hundreds and hundreds of cases around the country of African Americans who bought homes in neighborhoods that were previously all white, bought them legitimately, paid for them. Neighbors went to court, and the courts ordered them to be evicted because they had no right to live in a home that was for Caucasians only. Now, these actions of the courts were also a violation of the Constitution that have never been remedied. There are many African Americans who lost their homes because of these racial covenants.
You tell the story of a Bill Myers, a Black man who was a war veteran who was in a similar situation in Levittown, Pennsylvania. I believe this was in the 1950s, and he bought his home. And what was really interesting is that the police participated in sort of the mob riots that sort of happened outside his home. Can you tell us a little bit about Bill Myers and his story?
Well, sure. Not only did the police participate in this mob violence to drive the first African-American out of his home in Levittown, Pennsylvania, but frequently the police organized and led these riots, this mob violence. This is actually how I started writing the book. Mm. The Supreme Court had issued a decision in 2007 in which it prohibited the city of Louisville, Kentucky, from embarking on a very token plan to desegregate its schools. And the Supreme Court explained that the schools in Louisville, Kentucky were segregated because the neighborhoods were segregated de facto. As I described before, the Supreme Court said that it was by private prejudice and private businesses and people wanting to live with each other of the same race and income differences. And the Supreme Court said, since the segregation of Louisville, Kentucky was de facto, the school district was prohibited from doing anything to fix it because it wasn't a constitutional violation. Well, I read the Supreme Court decision. This was in 2007. And I remembered reading about something else that happened in Louisville, Kentucky, and very similar to the situation that you mentioned in Levittown, Pennsylvania. There was an all-white suburb in Louisville called Shively. There was a white homeowner in this all-white suburb who owned a home. It was a single-family home suburb. He had an African-American friend living in the center city of Louisville, renting an apartment, had a wife and a child. He was also a decorated Navy veteran. Mm-hmm. The white homeowner in the suburb of Shively bought a second home in his suburb and resold it to his African-American friend. And when the African-American friend moved in with his wife and daughter, an angry police-protected mob surrounded the home, threw rocks through the windows, firebombed and dynamited the home. Police made no effort to stop this, but when this riot was all over, the state of Kentucky arrested, tried, convicted, and jailed with a 15-year jail sentence, the white homeowner for sedition, for having sold a home in a white neighborhood to a Black family. So I said to myself, this doesn't sound to me much like de facto segregation. because the police are agents of government. It's a 14th Amendment violation for the police, the prosecutors, the criminal justice system to be mobilized to enforce racial boundaries. It's a civil rights violation. And I began to look into it further at that point. And that's when I discovered this case in Levittown, Pennsylvania, very similar. In that case, there was a police sergeant who tried to restrain the white mob, and he was demoted. And as I looked into it further, I found, and I'm not exaggerating here, there were hundreds of cases in cities all across the country, North, Midwest, as well as border states like Louisville. But the Pennsylvania is outside Philadelphia, as you described, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, where you are, San Francisco. Police protected, sometimes police organized and led mob violence to drive African Americans out of their homes. One of the ones that I discovered in this research, and I'm embarrassed, I forget the name of the area of Los Angeles. It's where Occidental College is located.
Eagle Rock.
That's the name. Mm-hmm. But in any event, in that area, the police actually organized a violent mob to drive an African American family out of a home it had legitimately purchased there.
Wow. Senator Cory Booker often tells the story that a dear friend of his, a white friend of his father's, went to the real estate agent and pretended to, you know, buy the house. And then when, you know, it was time to move in, they tried to protest it, but he was able to stay in this white neighborhood and, you know, got a better education and he lived a better life, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really interesting. I think about this too. When I was in elementary school, my mother lied about where we lived so we could go to a better school, a better school district. So the relationship between school and residential in terms of segregation, it's really deep because there's the income piece and the accumulating of wealth issue, but there's also the education issue. And if you're in a better neighborhood, you get a better quality of education, and that also can contribute to upward mobility. Oh my God, there's just so many things that are running through my head right now.
Well, let me say something about that. It's not only that the schools are better, but when African Americans were concentrated in neighborhoods that were less healthy and less well-resourced, their children weren't able to do as well in school, even if the schools were good. I remember once writing a column about asthma. As you may know, African American children in low-income neighborhoods, segregated neighborhoods, have asthma at four times the rate of middle-class children. And they have asthma at four times the rate because they live in more polluted neighborhoods, more diesel trucks driving through, more dilapidated buildings, more vermin in the environment, more empty lots kicking up dust. And if you have a child who has asthma, there's a chance, more than a child who doesn't, that that child might be up at night wheezing and come to school the next day drowsy. And if you have two groups of children who are identical in every respect, same racial composition, same social and economic background, same family structure, but one group has a higher rate of asthma than the other, that group is going to have lower average achievement no matter how good the schools are, because it's going to be sleepier. It doesn't make a big difference, but then when you begin to think of all the other conditions that impact children in poorly resourced neighborhoods, less well-maintained water delivery systems and more dilapidated buildings with lead paint peeling, African-American children have much higher rates of lead poisoning than white middle-class children and have lower achievement for that reason. Lead poisoning causes a decline in IQ. Yeah. So it's lead poisoning, it's asthma, it's economic insecurity, it's homelessness. And so no matter how good the schools are in those neighborhoods, they are going to have lower average achievement than schools and neighborhoods where children come to school healthy and well-rested and well-nourished in economically secure homes. So the effect of racial segregation is enormous in creating ongoing inequality, racial inequality in this country. It's not just in housing, it's in schools, it's in health. African Americans, as you know, have shorter life expectancies on average, greater rates of cardiovascular disease because they live in less healthy neighborhoods, less access to fresh food, again, more diesel trucks driving through. So the ongoing effects of the segregation that we, our government, has unconstitutionally created exists with us today, and they demand remedy.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk about that remedy, there's one point in your book that you make that I just really have to highlight. I was amazed when Black folks were able to get homes, right? There were a lot of predatory things that began to happen in the 1950s when Black folks were not able to get access to loans because of redlining, which is still haven't talked about, and FHA policies. And so they often had these mortgages that were really expensive. And to pay for those mortgages, they would have multiple people would live in the homes, right? And so the neighborhoods would become overcrowded. They'd be working so much. And so these FHA policies, these government policies ultimately created slums. And I think there's this myth that, like, you know, Black people, you know, we don't keep our neighborhoods. And there are conditions that are structural that have led to these kinds of neighborhoods. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, Richard?
Well, of course, you just did. You said it as well as I could.
Gotta take a teensy break here. I'll be fast. Alrighty then, let's just dive right back in.
The FHA not only prohibited African Americans from moving to suburban locations, but it refused to insure conventional mortgages for African Americans in existing urban neighborhoods. That's what we call redlining. The federal government drew maps of every metropolitan area in the country and colored red the neighborhoods in those maps that had a lot of African Americans living in them, or even that have African Americans, a few, living in them. Mm-hmm. The cover of my book, The Color of Law, has one of those red line maps. It's actually the map of Newark. And it shows how the federal government redlined neighborhoods. And the purpose of these maps was to indicate to the federal government where it would be too risky to insure mortgages. So as you said, as a result of that, slums were created, because if people can't get conventional mortgages, frequently there were speculators who exploited them by selling them homes on contract, something like the installment plan. If you put something away in a department store and you make payments and then you never finish it, you lose everything you put in. You don't gain any equity in the furniture or the dress that you've put aside. This is how these homes were sold. They were sold at much higher prices than the market required, and families gained no equity. So as you say, they had to subdivide their homes, rent apartments to other families. As the homes became more overcrowded, the people needed to conduct their social life in the streets, because every available space was being used for a bedroom for multiple families living in space that should have been for a single family. Government stopped collecting garbage as frequently in those neighborhoods as they became African American, and they became slums. And whites looked at those slums and they decide, well, African Americans are slum dwellers, and we don't want them near us, not understanding that the slum conditions were created by government policy. So you're absolutely right when you describe this.
Thank you so much for that. And when we think about remedies, how do we make this better? I just bought my first home a few years ago. And so I'm like, okay, appreciation and property value. When I think about writing this sort of residential segregation, I think that, like, the conventional wisdom by the government in the 1940s was that property values would go down if Black people moved into a neighborhood. And I feel like that's still the conventional wisdom, that if Black people live in a neighborhood, the property value goes down. And I think if you start messing with people's property value, people are going to get really, really incensed, right? There have been attempts to put government subsidized housing in different suburbs, and a lot of people in those suburbs like protest, and it gets really, really tricky when you talk about people's property value. What do you think the remedy for this residential segregation would be, Richard?
Well, let me say first about property values. In fact, because African Americans had access to so few homes, they paid more for homes in single-family home neighborhoods than whites were willing to pay for the same homes. Mm-hmm. Simply a question of supply and demand. So the supply available to African Americans was so small that they paid more. Property values went up when African Americans moved into a neighborhood for that reason. And frequently it was remarked that the best maintained houses in a neighborhood were the few that were owned by an African American. So this was a myth But of course, it becomes a self-perpetuating prophecy. What happened was that when those neighborhoods got a few African-Americans, speculators went into them, tried to persuade white families that their property values would go down because African-Americans were living in them. In my book, I describe speculators that hired black women to walk baby carriages through white neighborhoods to try to scare whites that the neighborhood was turning all black. They even organized home burglaries to persuade whites that they'd better flee that neighborhood. The speculators then bought those homes from whites at far below market value because they persuaded whites that their homes would lose even more value if they didn't sell quickly, and then resold them to African Americans at much more than market value, creating enormous profits. This was a commonplace practice. It was called blockbusting in the 20th century, and it further contributed to the segregation of this country.
Wow. That reminds me of the subprime loans that plagued the financial crash in 2008, the subprime mortgages that happened that affected disproportionately African-American folks. What would you think, what can we do to make this better?
Well, the policies to redress segregation are well known. There's no mystery about them. We should have an affirmative action program in housing that subsidizes African-Americans to move to neighborhoods that are now unaffordable to working class families of either race, but that would have been affordable to African-Americans at the time. We should abolish zoning laws.
Government subsidies to working class people, particularly African-Americans, to move to certain neighborhoods to desegregate them.
And then not just government.
Okay.
Banks and the real estate agencies and the insurance companies and the developers that created the segregation have an obligation to contribute to those remedies as well.
Okay.
We should stop placing all of our affordable housing in low-income segregated neighborhoods to reinforce their segregation. So what's missing, and let me conclude with this, what's missing is not policy ideas to redress segregation. Those are well known. What's missing is a new civil rights movement that's going to engage in the kinds of militant action that the civil rights movement engaged in the 1950s and 60s to make it uncomfortable to maintain these policies of segregation, to create the political support to implement the kinds of programs to redress segregation that we know. I am actually working with a group of national civil rights leaders to create a new movement to redress racial segregation. That movement will create local committees in communities around the country to create the political pressure to implement the policies that I say are well known to redress segregation. And we're about to launch it. And if any of your listeners want to be on the mailing list to receive the announcement of the launch of this new movement to redress racial segregation, they should send an email, and I'll give it to you now, Carrie, C-A-R-R-I-E, at nmrrs.org. That's nmrrs.org for the new movement to redress racial segregation. And hopefully, we'll see some of these policies implemented in the not too distant future.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Richard. Richard is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. I'd like to end the podcast with this question, what else is true? And basically, this question comes out of my therapy in the community resiliency model. It's about being in the space of both and. When things are hard, what helps you get through, basically. So, Richard, for you, what helps you get through? What else is true?
Well, you know, this may surprise you, but I found the research that I did for this book very hopeful. I found it very hopeful because so long as we believe that this all happened by accident, it was natural to believe that it could only unhappen by accident, and I didn't see how that was going to happen. Once we understand that this segregated pattern everywhere in the country was created by explicit government policy, it's easy to see that equally explicit government policy can fix it. And we are now having a more accurate and passionate discussion about race and the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in this country than we ever have had before in American history. It's not that it's gone far enough, it needs to go much farther. It's not that there isn't an enormous white supremacist opposition to it, but I take great hope in the Black Lives Matter movement demonstrations that enlisted 20 million Americans, mostly white, protest the police abuse and murder of African Americans. I think we're in a period where the future can look bright. despite the fact that it may not seem that way immediately. So that gives me hope.
That's wonderful. That is a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much, Richard Rothstein. The Color of Law, it is riveting. You should go and read it, everyone. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you.
Wow. My mind is just really blown. I mean, it's so angering, so much of the history. And I think it is really disingenuous of the Supreme Court in their decision, and disingenuous for anyone to say that we should just let things be when the government explicitly, if you read his book, they explicitly created policies to segregate neighborhoods when it was completely not even necessary. I mean, you have to read his book. You know, I was in a conversation with someone last year, and they were like, structural racism, is that really a thing? And I cited residential segregation. Another point that he didn't get to that he raised in his book is that our schools are still very much segregated, you know, 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education. So we need a new civil rights movement. We need a new civil rights movement to redress this, to kind of talk about what our government did and the continuing effects of those policies, continuing effects. When we think about the wealth gap, when we think about education, wow. I'm like, I'm just imagining like people in their property value. I wonder how that's gonna go. But that's up to all of you out there. Here we go.
Thank you for listening to The Laverne Cox Show. Please rate, review, subscribe, and share with everyone you know. Join me next week when I'll be talking to actress, writer, and activist Jen Richards about dating as a trans woman. It's going to be lit. It's going to be raw, real, and amazing. You have to check it out. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laverne Cox and on Facebook at Laverne Cox for Real. Until next time, stay in the love. The Laverne Cox Show is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.